Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up. I talked to the former British Prime Minister Gordon Brown. He helped navigate a global exit from the Great Recession. Now he's calling for a global task force to beat the pandemic. Then,
when we talk about another flu pandemic happening, it's not a matter of if, but when.
The Netflix series that predicted this very catastrophe before anyone had even heard of COVID-19, featuring veteran virus hunter Dr. Dennis Carroll, who joins me. Plus, before there was the great jazz musician Wynton Marsalis, there was his father, the late legendary Ellis Marsalis. A conversation with Walter Isaacson about grief, legacy, and love. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour, working from home in London. As coronavirus deaths continue to rise, worries about the life and death impact of a shuttered global economy also grow by the day. President Trump has resorted to his old political playbook, saying that he'll temporarily stop all immigration into the United States in an effort to protect American jobs. More than 20 million have been lost amid this pandemic, and that is just in the U.S. Around the world, tens of millions are facing job losses and severe economic contractions are on the horizon. Thankfully, deaths are now at a slower rate in these countries that were hit hard at the start. But what happens when the virus reaches the developing world? The World Food Programme warns the number of people suffering acute hunger could almost double to more than 265 million because of the impact of the virus. Former British Prime Minister Gordon Brown is renewing his call for a coordinated global effort against the pandemic and its aftershocks. Having been at the center of the international move to tackle the 2008 financial crisis, he's best placed to offer a battle plan now. Gordon Brown is joining me from his hometown of North Queensferry in Scotland. Prime Minister, welcome to the programme. Let me ask you, because there does seem to be a contradiction. It is a global pandemic, which kind of for the first time is notable for the absence of a global response. You've been calling for it from the early days. Tell me where we are right now.
Well, it's not only a global pandemic that needs a global response, there's a global economic crisis that also needs a global economic response. And if people sitting at home are wondering, saying, well, look, I'm worried about my family, I'm worried about my community, I'm worried about my neighborhood, I'm worried about my own country. If we think of the consequences of this disease taking root in Africa or in some of the poorest countries of Asia or Latin America or the Middle East, and then a second or perhaps third or fourth round of the disease comes back to hit us in every other country in the world, then we have very, very serious consequences to face. So to think locally, you've got to act globally to solve the problem nationally.
Again, this is what happens when we have live broadcasting in these circumstances where the technology sometimes can fail for a while, but we'll get it back. So what we're going to do now is go to my next guest, because few know more about infectious diseases than my next guest, who is Dr. Dennis Carroll. He directed the Pandemic, Influenza and Emerging Threats Unit of USAID. That's the Agency for International Development in the United States. He did that for 15 years. And during that time, he helped identify more than 2,000 viruses in animals that can make us humans sick, which is most likely how coronavirus originated, according to the World Health Organization. And he featured in the 0.0 Netflix series Pandemic, which predicted an outbreak months earlier. Here's the trailer.
100 years ago, a deadly influenza virus infected hundreds of millions of people, somewhere in the order of 50 to 100 million deaths. When we talk about another flu pandemic happening, it's not a matter of if, but when.
A new strain of bird flu.
This is definitely one of the most lethal influenza viruses that we have seen so far.
It just takes one person to start an outbreak.
It will leave its mark. The result would be hundreds of millions of people that would likely die. That's why I do what I do.
We're making a vaccine that could treat all future versions of flu.
This vaccine could eradicate influenza as we know it.
The problem's so widespread, the World Health Organization is calling the refusal to vaccinate one of the biggest threats of 2019.
A healthy child has the ability to build up immunity naturally.
I know that what I do is important to my patients, but what am I doing to myself and my family?
Within 1 month, the virus can spread throughout the country. A month after that, widespread throughout the world.
The next pandemic is going to start. We just don't know where or how, but we know it will.
That poses an existential threat to us as a species.
And that was Dr. Dennis Carroll in the film, and he is now joining me from Washington. So, welcome to the program. You know, watching the series from the first episode to the sixth episode, you just thought, oh my God, how did they know? How did they know? And of course, you didn't film it now. You filmed it in the 2018-2019 flu season. Did you know that something like this could happen so soon?
Well, the answer, Christiane, is absolutely. The emergence of this particular coronavirus really comes as no surprise. We could never predict which would be the next virus, and we could never predict exactly when. But it was clear that the dynamics that drive viruses circulating in wildlife, the spillover into people, they're intensifying. And the frequency with which these are happening is going up. It's all driven by population pressures. So what we're seeing with COVID-19 virus is symptomatic of sort of a new age. We are going to see more and more of these events as we move further into the 21st century.
So interestingly, we showed it in the trailer. It's sort of like these virus sleuths, investigators, people who need to keep an eye on everything that's going on in this field. And they were in the Democratic Republic of Congo because of Ebola. They were in Egypt and Lebanon because of various versions of flu, whether it was swine flu, avian flu, all those that cropped up in 2000s. We saw doctors in the United States, doctors in India. It looks like there is a huge amount of knowledge, just a huge amount of knowledge, and people like yourself and these characters on the lookout. Can you explain in today's context why then, including the fact that there were pandemic playbooks, we seem to have been caught so completely, for want of a better word, with our trousers down?
Well, first off, I think the fact that this virus was picked up and identified as a coronavirus, remember, it began as an event of unknown causes. And within a fairly short period of time, a matter of 2 to 3 weeks after it was first publicly identified, there was a clear recognition that, one, we were not looking at an influenza virus. We were looking at a coronavirus that has striking similarities to its cousin, the SARS virus. The surprise wasn't so much the emergence and the early spread. It was the lack of a coordinated regional or even global response. And that, I think, as you noted, that's where we're caught with our pants down, not so much about the biology of this virus, but the political actions that responded to this virus, or the lack of action that responded to that virus. This, I think, to many of us comes as the real surprise, the lack of early and effective response, and more importantly, the lack of a well-coordinated global response. As your previous guest, Prime Minister Gordon Brown, noted, you know, this is a global event, and global events require global coordination and global response. So if our pants were down when this occurred, it really had to do with the failure of the global community to really come together, recognize the singular global characteristics of this event early, and mount a coordinated global response.
So some people will say, well, hang on a second, we've never seen anything like this, something that spread so fast, something that really took so much of the world in its grip, in its deathly grip. But you also point out that, well, in fact, yes, but there were previous times when you did see the President of the United States leading the global effort. You talk about President George W. Bush getting on the phone when the crisis erupted under his watch. You talk about, you know, President Obama twice, once, I believe, with swine flu, once with Ebola, having to get on and marshal a global response. Just talk to me about that compared to what's happening right now from the White House.
Well, let's go back to the 2009 H1N1 pandemic. That was picked up in early April of 2009. And very quickly, it was recognized as a novel influenza virus spreading out of North America. And by the end of April, President Obama had already stepped forward and declared this a public health emergency, already mobilizing resources across the entirety of the U.S. government to begin preparing for a response. WHO didn't declare this as a pandemic until June. So what you saw with President Obama was really listening to his technical experts and using the levers of the White House to begin mobilizing immediately what turned out to be a highly effective response. The second point I want to make is that President Obama also very early on not only declared this a national emergency, he reached out across the globe to other leaders to begin to lay the foundation for a coordinated global response. And so it was that twin sort of line of activity, mobilizing national preparedness and beginning to coordinate a global response, even before a pandemic was declared, really sort of highlighted the difference between this current administration, which quite frankly, really did not start marshaling a response until March of this year, 3 months after we recognized this as a significant public health event.
Okay, I think viewers will be unbelievably interested to see this series, because it also starts with one of the main doctors who is undergoing sort of a drill in one of the New York hospitals to receive a first, you know, infected patient. It's unbelievably chilling, and it reflects exactly what's going on right now. But what I want to ask you now, from your experience and your expertise. You are an expert in, and I'm going to say it, the discovery of zoonotic viruses. Obviously, we kind of understand that means viruses in animals. Tell us about this particular virus, the origin, where you think it came from, and this animal to human transmission that we keep seeing.
Well, it's important to recognize every new emerging viral threat we're dealing with, whether it was SARS of 2002, the influenza pandemic of 2009, the Ebola West Africa epidemic of 2014. All of these viruses existed prior to the outbreak or the beginnings of the pandemic in wildlife. They're circulating today. Every new virus that we're going to see over the coming decades, over the course of this century, already exists, and it is circulating in its natural habitat in wildlife populations. The zoonotic component has to do with when those wildlife animals, whether it's a bat, a non-human primate, or a rodent, is carrying one of these viruses, and it ends up proximal, nearby a human settlement or a human population. And viruses have a very strong motivation to look for new ecologic niches. They're always trying to diversify their host range. And given the opportunity, they will jump from a bat into a person and look for a new place to replicate and grow and spread further. And it's that phenomena
of
jumping, spilling over, that is behind the COVID-19 event that began sometime in November or December of this past year.
Can you just lay to rest what some people are afraid of, or that they think is how it happened, that somebody in Wuhan or wherever ate the bat and that's how they got it? Is it in the eating of the animal, or how does an animal spill over, shed the virus?
Okay. Well, there are several routes that we know about. And let me first off say this, what we know about the spillover events really comes out of 20 years of intensive research in the field, monitoring and evaluating these events. And so we have quite a lot of insight into how the spillover event occurs. The COVID-19 virus, really there were two potential routes by way it made its way from its natural reservoir, which is the horseshoe bat, into human populations. It could have, and we're not sure about this, but the early reports suggested that an intermediary wildlife animal, pangolin, was infected by a bat, and that pangolin was brought into a wildlife market where wildlife animals are traded, and that there was an exposure event in that market that could have led to a spillover. Not dissimilar to what we saw with SARS in 2002, where a civet cat acted as an intermediary, moving a bat virus into human populations. But we also know that bats can directly infect people by depositing their feces in areas where people are exposed, and you can get the virus directly from that exposure as well. We're not sure which route was taken, but we are clear that this is a natural virus and that the way it moved into the human population was through a natural route.
So another thing that people have, you know, there's been a whole load of conspiracies and theories that maybe it was a mistake in a lab in Wuhan. Maybe the conspiracies say that it was a bioweapon being developed. Now, the WHO was particularly asked about that today and has quashed it as far as they did. They said there's absolutely no scientific evidence at all to back up either of those theories, that it did come from an animal. Would you agree with that?
I would agree, absolutely. There's been some very good deep genetic work looking at this particular virus, and it has the genetic signatures of a natural virus. There's nothing man-made about it. But the second point I want to make is that we do recognize that accidental release from laboratories is a real risk. And so we need to pay attention to that. And I would hope that as we talk more about this issue, that the global community addresses the vulnerabilities that we have for a future event where there is an accidental release. But in this case, COVID-19 virus, everything points to this being not only a natural virus, but its introduction into the human population was not by way of a laboratory.
There's the other thing. Obviously, everybody is waiting with bated breath for some kind of vaccine, some kind of mitigation that will allow people to go back. We hear with this cacophony for ending lockdowns, obviously many people are in pain, financial, economic pain, etc. And also you want this virus to be killed off. And they say it won't happen safely unless there is a vaccine. Well, today, the health secretary here in England said that the Oxford trial of vaccines at Oxford University would start their first human trials this Thursday. And in the series that you took part in, Dr. Jake, he is also working on vaccines and now has moved to trying to work on a COVID vaccine. Just tell me what you know about that part of it and how, you know, how long you think we might have to wait.
Well, first off, Christiana, a vaccine is the holy grail. This is a virus, I think, that there is very strong consensus. It will become an endemic virus coming back every winter season along with influenzas. So in the absence of a vaccine, we're going to be very challenged societally as well as economically and how to best manage this. There have been much speculation that 12 to 18 months is going to be required before we see a vaccine. But let me also offer a cautionary note. We've never developed a vaccine against this family of viruses before. So while we're hopeful that a vaccine against this virus will be forthcoming, it really won't be available, if it's available at all, for at least another year to year and a half. And for the, you know, it's also needed for 8 billion people. It's going to be several years before we get to the level of production where we can even achieve that level of coverage. So there are an enormous amount of uncertainties. We're not even sure to the extent that this virus will trigger natural immunity. So there's a really significant effort underway within the science community to understand the immunologic response to those people who have been infected. Is there natural immunity? And if so, can we use that experience to help accelerate the development of a vaccine? And if there isn't natural immunity, what is it that we have to do to trigger a level of immunity that the natural infection doesn't? So enormous outstanding questions remain to be answered. We're hopeful a vaccine. I think more urgently, we're likely to see the emergence of an effective pharmaceutical, a treatment. And that I'm much more hopeful that we'll see become available earlier than we will see a vaccine.
And quite quickly, because I just, you mentioned 8 billion people. I think you believe, and many scientists believe, that part of this, because it's animals to humans, is because of the huge population of the world right now. And as people rise from poverty into the ability to buy meat, protein, etc., the need for animals to eat, or the desire for animals to eat, has exploded exponentially. Is this ever, ever going to then become manageable if that's the inevitable trend?
Well, first off, the point you're making is absolutely right. There are 8 billion people on this planet now, and that is an extraordinary number. If we were having this discussion 100 years ago, there were 6 billion fewer people on this planet. You can't have this accelerated intensification of the human footprint on this planet without dramatically disrupting natural ecosystems. And we're seeing within the 21st century two dramatic examples of how those ecosystems are being disrupted. Climate change is one, and the second is the acceleration of zoonotic diseases. But in both cases, these events are driven by unintended consequences of how we live. And we can better manage those. There are risky behaviors and practices that we undertake that we can bring under control. Just by way of example, the very existence of live animal markets in many parts of the world today create real vulnerabilities for spillover of these viruses. We can do a better job managing people's access to animal protein. And we need to think carefully about how it is that, you know, we expand our settlements, how we expand our agricultural productivity, how we make sure the world's population is fed. Those are goals and targets that if we don't manage well, we'll see more zoonosis, we'll see more impact on climate change. So we can manage it.
Really important.
We live in a risky world. We can manage this risk very effectively if we are careful.
Yeah. Very important warnings, very important analysis. Thank you so much for your expertise, Dr. Dennis Carroll. And everybody should see this series, Pandemic. It is incredible. Now, let's bring back former British Prime Minister Gordon Brown. Prime Minister, we were talking about, before we had technical difficulties, the global necessity of responding to this. It's a global pandemic, but it hasn't been. So you were beginning to explain it. What we see is even Europe, which is meant to be a European Union, people have been, well, countries have been competing for their own equipment and all that they need. We've seen in the United States that there's competition even between states and between, you know, within states. So what do you think, and do you believe it's on the way, needs to be done, can be done to make this a global response?
Look, it's obvious. We've got America first, we've got China first, we've got India first, we've got Japan first, we've got Russia first. And this has been a tendency, a trend of the times, an aggressive unilateral nationalism. But I think most people realize that this is a global economic emergency, and it's also a global health emergency. And I think people realize that unless we solve the problem in some of the poorest countries of the world, which could bring the disease back into the richest countries of the world, we will not solve the problem at all. We need a global effort at a vaccine. We need to build up global capacity and testing equipment. We need to protect these countries so that they don't carry the disease back into the rest of the world. So for all these reasons, people sitting at home this evening, I think, do realize that to protect themselves locally, we have got to act globally. We're concerned about our families, about our communities, about our country, but we've got to act globally if we're going to rid ourselves of this disease.
So I'm going to play this little bit of a soundbite from Dr. Tedros, the Director General of the World Health Organization, basically amplifying what you're saying, but with a rather chilling warning.
We need global solidarity that's cemented on genuine national unity. Without the two, without national unity and global solidarity, trust us, the worst is yet ahead of us. Let's prevent this tragedy.
Prime Minister, that is really chilling to think that the worst is still ahead of us. Do you have commitments? Do you have a game plan for this G20 appeal that you've made?
Yeah, yes, I think so. When he talks about the worst ahead of us, I mean, the predictions are that at least 300,000 people may lose their life in Africa, 900,000 in Asia, in the poorest countries, because they simply don't have the protection that we have. They can't do social distancing in the way that we can. There is no social safety net that allows them to stop working when they feel that their health is at risk. So they go to work and they risk their health. And of course, there is no proper health provision, testing, ventilators, and what problems we've seen in the developed world are even greater, obviously, in the developing world. But solidarity is actually self-interest. And I think people will understand when we explain that if you allow this disease to have a second round and a third round, then we're all going to be affected. And that's why there's got to be a global race for the vaccine. We've got to work together, because we've got to manufacture it and get it to every country in the world when it's ready. If it's cure and therapeutics, as we've just heard from our previous speaker, then again, we've got to have global capacity. We've got to build up our capacity to do this. There's no use people competing against each other for a small amount of capacity and supply. We need to build up the capacity. And I think these things can be done. Now, why am I more confident than perhaps the reports in the newspapers suggest about global cooperation? Because I think we will soon see a pledging conference to raise money for health. We need $8 billion to speed the search for the vaccine, speed the search for treatments and therapeutics and diagnostics. These are networks of scientists and experts who are working on this, who need financial support to do this at a global level. I think the European Union is ready to hold a pledging conference. My information is that countries like Japan, Korea, Britain itself and Norway would be very much wanting to be part of that. I think China and America will be drawn in as Africa and Latin America, and of course the Middle East, say that we need this. And there are already signs that countries are prepared to contribute. So mm-hmm. I think in the next few weeks, perhaps this pledge conference will be May the 4th, I'm told. Perhaps in the next few days then, we will be able to say the global health program for the vaccine, for the therapeutics and diagnostics is going to be supported this year. And of mm-hmm. course, we'll have to do something similar for next year. So there is a chance of progress, despite all the statements that are being made that suggests America first has gone global.
Well, look, this is really interesting because what you are describing is a kind of return to normal procedure when there's a big issue and the world gets together along the lines that you've described. But it is America first. Under President Trump, you know perfectly well that there's no desire to lead the world. Lead America, yes, but not lead the world. And you just heard our previous guest contrast President Trump's action with that of President George W. Bush and President Obama. So bipartisan. So can the world go it alone globally without the United States? And obviously, added to that is, how can WHO go it without American money? And what kind of signal does that send?
Well, it's very interesting because I saw a Pew opinion poll in the United States suggesting that the population of the United States, 80 to 90% of them, whether Republican or Democrat, understood that global cooperation to deal with this health epidemic, it was absolutely important, very important or fairly important, according to, in one case, more than 90% of the population. So I'm not sure that America wants to stay out of everything, and I'm not sure that America does not want to support the vaccine search, which is global, or the building up of capacity. And I think we've got to accept that it does take time to persuade people, as we found in 2009, that global cooperation is essential. You know, when we decided to have a G20 to deal with the financial crisis and decided that the G7 and mm-hmm. only a small group of advanced economies was not good enough if you're going to deal with a global financial crisis, there was resistance at the beginning. Countries didn't want to join. Countries didn't want the remit mm-hmm. that we wanted. We had to persuade people. It took time. But over a period of weeks, we managed to get people around the same table. And over the next few weeks, I think you just cannot give up. I think President Gorbachev said that he wanted on his tombstone the words, "We tried." And I think it's important to say that we keep trying, because the price of failure here is that in this generation's, what Roosevelt called a rendezvous with destiny, in this generation's moment of truth, we will suffer the condescension of posterity for failing to act globally and to act locally, nationally, and globally when we have both a health crisis and an economic crisis. The stakes, in my view, are very high. And I do think you cannot just give up and say, President Trump said this, so let's actually just accept that there's going to be no cooperation. I think you've got to keep trying. And I do think that on health, which some results.
I do need to actually press you on this, because he did actually pull the United States out of paying for a global organization that the UN heads call the WHO. That's hundreds of millions of dollars in the middle of a pandemic.
I just want to ask you,
because I want to know whether the world, if the United States chooses to forfeit its traditional role as leader of these kinds of events, if President Trump decides not to, can you all do it without? That's the simple question.
I think we've got to do it, whether America comes in or not, but it's far better if America comes in. You've got to remember, President Trump signed a G20 communique only a few days ago saying he wanted to increase and extend the mandate of the World Health Organization, put more money into the global search for a vaccine, give more money to developing countries, and then we have this change of mind. He can change his mind again. But my pledging conference idea would start with the European Union and Japan, involve Canada, Korea, Norway, Britain, and all these countries. And I think at that stage, America would have to make a choice. Mm-hmm. Does it want to come in? The rest of the world wants to work together, or does it stay out? I don't think you give up simply because President mm-hmm. Trump says he doesn't want to be part of this. You keep finding new ways of dealing with this similar problem, that we've got to find the global resources to deal with the health problem. And also, of course, to deal with the economic problems that we may come onto that the world faces mm-hmm. as well.
Well, that is the big question, obviously, because a lot of this is being driven by the frozen economies. Again, you were there at the last great crash, recession of 2008-2009. I mean, do you understand the impetus to want to open up economies? Do you understand President Trump? Or is there a way to do it whereby you mitigate both the economic effect once you've got the health crisis in check?
Well, I think that you're dealing with an economic problem that comes in two stages. The first stage was to prevent the loss of jobs or to protect people who were losing their jobs with Social Security of some sort. And it was to provide the resources necessary for the national health systems. So you've been through this first phase. And look, we've had innovation at a national level that ought to be replicated also at a global level. I mean, the American Fed is virtually supporting junk bonds in the marketplace. The British government is supporting, with the central bank, supporting the fiscal policy of the government directly. So we've had massive innovation, even beyond what happened in 2009, in fiscal and monetary policies in these countries. But the second stage will need global coordination. You will need countries to come together, because the fiscal, monetary, and central bank coordination that is necessary for the second stage, which is to get growth back into the world economy, is going to be very considerable indeed. So you might be able to deal with the first stage by individual countries doing their own thing. But if you want to get back to global growth, and America wants to get back to growth, and it's a trading economy, it's not simply an economy that can be completely isolated forever, then you have to have a push which involves China, Japan, involves Europe, as well as America.
Okay. I want to ask you, as a former British Prime Minister, former Chancellor of the Exchequer, did you ever in your wildest nightmares think that you might see what many are calling a pretty disastrous situation here in the United Kingdom, where the death rate is very, very high compared to the rest of Europe, and where really pitifully short supplies of PPE, of all the things that are necessary for the frontline workers, the number of frontline workers who are dying? There was a pandemic playbook here. You know, are you just surprised? I mean, how do you assess what went wrong here?
Well, we've had to deal with past problems in infectious diseases. We've had to deal, obviously, around the world with SARS. We've had to deal with Ebola. Fortunately, these diseases never hit the advanced economies in the way that this disease has hit. And I do feel, and the first thing I've got to say when asked about what's happening in my own country, I do feel for all those people who are losing their lives and those families who are suffering bereavements. And I do feel for the health service workers who are doing a fantastic, indeed a magnificent job, but are putting their lives at risk every day to save lives. They are risking their lives. And I think at this moment in our history, it is not the time for me to criticize or to try to go over what happened in the last few weeks. It's the time to be constructive. So we need testing, and therefore we need to increase our capacity to be able to give people these tests so that they can either be clear of the disease or find that they need to isolate themselves. We need to increase the capacity in equipment, personal equipment for health service workers, and we need to increase it in ventilators. Equally, in all these cases, this is a problem that every other country are facing. So we need to find a way of increasing global capacity in every single area. Is there any point in any state in the United States or country fighting amongst each other simply to get a limited supply of capacity of these goods? We need to increase the global capacity. And that's why I do think there is a case for people coming together, even at this stage when we're dealing with the disease and there is still a shortage of testing equipment and a shortage of personal equipment for health service workers. We need to find a way of increasing global capacity. And I would be certainly putting a minister and asking other countries to put a minister in charge of a plan to increase global capacity. And that would help America, it would help Britain, it would help Europe, and it would help the developing countries. That is something that I think is urgent.
All right. Well, we really appreciate you being with us tonight. Prime Minister Gordon Brown, thank you for joining us on this incredibly important issue.
Thank you.
Now we turn to a heartfelt conversation about grief and the healing power of music with our next guest. And he is the great jazz musician Wynton Marsalis. He's in conversation with our Walter Isaacson. He opens up about losing his father, the New Orleans jazz patriarch Ellis Marsalis, who died aged 85 earlier this month after contracting coronavirus. Wynton Marsalis reflects on his father's legacy and on how jazz can help us all right now.
Wynton Marsalis, welcome to the show.
Right, it's great to be here, Walter. Great to see you.
Hey, man, I'm sorry about your daddy.
Oh, man, you know, thank you. You know, you're not New Orleanian, so you know the position that he occupied and who he was. So we all miss him. But, you know, he was very unfussy about stuff in life and in death. He went out the way he was, so...
You said he went out with the cool of a jazz man to me at one point. What do you mean by that?
I mean, he wasn't complaining and whining. He accepted it. But he had a lot of underlying conditions, too. My father was taking up to 18 medications a day before this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, he was struggling, but he never complained. So you could never tell how he was doing. And even in the end, when they were increasing his oxygen, he was having more and more problems breathing. When the nurse would come in and say, "Are you okay?" he would say, "Yeah, I'm fine."
And he was pretty accepting at the end.
Very. He was always accepting. Even the end was what he made it to 85. So, but he could come to grips with life. He had a very holistic view. Like we were joking just two nights before he went into the hospital, I was joking with him about him perhaps having it, and he said, He said, "Well, man, you know, I said, man, I don't think it's your time for COVID." He said, "I don't determine the time." So he started joking. He said, "Anyway, because it's your loved one that dies, doesn't make it any more or less significant than anybody else's. A lot of people are suffering." So that was always his philosophy. And, you know, I was laughing. I said, "Well, my friend," I was talking about a friend of mine. I said, "Well, my friend who has both parents passed away," said his parents signed the do not resuscitate. And he said, "You know, you always think you'll do it until you get to that moment." So, and this friend of mine is in his late 70s. So he was talking about his parents, of course, who had passed on. He said, "When you get to that moment, you're always thinking, well, maybe I should just resuscitate them because you don't want them to go." He said, that wasn't his vibe. He was like, "Well, don't resuscitate me." He had a do not resuscitate. don't get to that moment with me.
Tell me about going to clubs with him when you were a little kid and you listened to him play gigs.
You know, I was always with them, and they were struggling. I mean, it wasn't glamorous places. It was people struggling. You know, they've never had a lot of people in the clubs, really. He had a good little period in the early 70s at this club called Lou and Charlie's. But in the early years, when I was like 3, 4, and 5, man, they were struggling. Country clubs, older people, black and white, black and red tile on the ground, sparkly kind of tile with the Sam and Dave on the jukebox, combination restaurant bar, Old South segregated.
At one point, you watched him play a gig with only one or two people
right.
in the club.
That's right.
From that?
Oh, man, I saw him play a gig. It was like the gig stopped at 2:30. So one thing about that way of life is you're always out late. So my entire life, I was always out 1:30, 12:30. So this gig ended at 2:30, but he could lock the club up. It was Lou and Charlie's at a later time, and there was one guy in the club was drunk sitting at a table. So I went to the piano and told my daddy, "Man, let's go. It's 2 a.m. There's nobody in here. Let's go." And I pointed to the guy who was inebriated. He had a little too much spiritual involvement, and I said, "Let's go, man." He said, "Man, this gig ends at 2:30. I said, "Man, nobody's in here. Look around." I pointed at the club. It was empty. He looked at me and said, "Man, go sit your ass down and listen to some music, man, for a change." So, you know, that was the first time I ever, I used the King English because that's how he talked to me. So I went and sat down. That was like the first time of all the gigs I went on that I actually listened to the music. Because even though I was always in the clubs, I never was really listening to what they were playing. I was always running around listening to whatever older people were talking. You know, there's always people inebriated of the 5 or 6 people. There's always some kind of interesting human thing going on. And then I sat down, I listened to him play. And I was just looking around the club thinking, what makes somebody play this good for nobody at 2:15 in the morning? And, you know, just for that 30 minutes, it's like, it made me understand something about what it means to have integrity. And I kid you not that when I walk on stages around the world over all these years, many times I walk out and I think about that night. I think about what I learned that night about just, you know, you do a thing because you do it. And the meaning of it is that it's being done. And he taught me that without, he didn't preach to me, but then I understood, you know.
What else did he teach you besides music?
The main thing I learned from my father is in the 1970s, you know, you being from New Orleans being such a backwards racist town. And my father was very conscious, like a jazz musician. But like a jazz musician, he also was not segregated. So we grew up in Kenner, which was really segregated. So you never saw black and white people together. But because my father was a jazz musician, you saw him with white musicians. And he would be in a barbershop, black barbershop. Everybody, we got our afros, black power, everybody talking about white folks in the way that they would talk about them. And my father would never go along with the status quo conversation. And he used to make me mad. I'd be like, man, why are you embarrassing me up here in the shop taking this humanistic view when nobody's about that? And he was nonplussed, man. He just never, he didn't go with the group. His thing was always attack people that's in front of you. If you're going to say something disparaging, to don't waste it on them. The them is right in front of you. And it's not just some words. I saw him actually live by that credo to espouse what he believed. Some of what they were saying he believed. Other parts of it he didn't. And when it got to that kind of extreme, kind of xenophobic thing that groups of people love to fall into because it gives them the illusion of power, he never went for that.
He was a great teacher and, of course, for many years taught at the University of New Orleans. I remember about 20 years ago when he retired as a teacher, you and all your brothers got together at the arena there and did a farewell concert to celebrate his life as a teacher. I think you actually did some Louis Armstrong, Strutting with Some Barbecue. Why don't you tell me a little bit about that, but play a few bars of Strutting with Some Barbecue.
Yeah, my brothers, I, Harry Connick. Don't forget Harry, you know, it was always in the house. Mm-hmm. Musicians always were coming to my house. My father was always, we're people, we're like a family. And there's musicians all over the country who eventually are like that. He would have the same pride in Harry Connick, in Terrence Blanchard, and Donald Harrison. He had the same pride in them, Reginald Veal, as he had in my brothers, or in me. It wasn't a thing of a, these are my kids. He wasn't like the kind of family type, proprietary group person. He was a world kind of. We played Strutting with Some Barbecue. That's another one of Pops' songs you can easily mess up. That goes up. And then Pops go on to play all kind of fantastic stuff on that, too.
You wrote on your Facebook page something very beautiful about your father. It was, my daddy was a humble man with a lyrical sound that captured the spirit of place, New Orleans, Crescent City, the Big Easy. Like many parents, he sacrificed for us and made so much possible. Not only material things, but things of substance and beauty, like the ability to hear complicated music and to read books, to see and contemplate art, to be philosophical and to be kind, but also understand that a time and place may require a pugilistic-minded expression of ignorance.
Yeah. Yeah, he had all of that, man. You know, I'm about to get full just thinking about how kind a man he was. You know, my daddy was, I know he could talk you to death, but he was kind. Like he was, he used to always tell me, man, leave people alone, man. It's hard enough out here. And sometimes he would say, you know, you got to be able to put your foot in some behind. And I was much more aggressive than him, you know, even growing up. But I would make my daddy laugh, you know, because he was really a kind of sweet, very philosophical guy. Probably had a hard time growing up, you know, in his neighborhood. Whereas with me, I never had a hard time. You know, it's like, okay, if we're gonna get to that, you're not gonna see me after school. See me now. Mm-hmm. I'm not gonna wait. And then you seeing me. Yeah, he was, you know, he had a lot of depth as a person. He was very kind toward people of all kinds, very advanced in his thinking. He had a very loving spirit. So many things. The first time I ever heard of one was from him, man. Like the South African struggle, the when musicians were playing in Cuba, the importance of intellectual development, non-racism of any kind. We have a lot to overcome if we want to, but it's such a weakness that if we could address it, we would be so much more progressive a nation, and we could get so much further than we are. You know, I'm just saying one thing, and I know I'm going on. If we ever could ever stop confusing business and with civics. Civics is investment. I want your kids to be educated. I don't want your old people to die because they can't afford a $200,000 pill. That is ethics. It's not a business for us to exploit. Business has its own space. But for some reason, we don't believe in civics. I mean, it's not a civics. It's business. It's not civics. And civics is the investment branch of our way of life. And we have to get business out of civics. We need an educated populace. We need people to not have to die because they don't have insurance. I mean, it's just common sense. It's crazy, man.
A few days ago, you did a virtual gala for Jazz at Lincoln Center, which you helped run. And it was pretty amazing. You did Charlie Parker's Yardbird Suite from around the world.
It's hard to learn how tears can burn one's heart, but that's the thing that I found out. Too late, I guess, because I'm a man.
Tell me how you pulled that together.
Well, I was talking to Victor Goins 3 weeks ago, and we went to kindergarten together in New Orleans at Martinez. And we still work together, and he runs a jazz studies program at Northwestern. And he said, man, we ought to do the type of things that I'm doing with my students. We ought to do that as a band. So we have also an engineer named Todd Whitelock. And we came up with a way to record songs where we could play in time. I had a meeting with the band on the phone, and we talked through the arrangement. Right here, Ryan plays lead. Right here, Sherman has lead. This is call and response. And it's easy because everybody the band arranges. So when it's... The band is so capable, it's hard to really even explain what it's like to have a band with 13 arrangers in the band. So in 2 days, we did the track. We set the rhythm track in, then the horns played, then the drums redid the track. So drums the foundation. Then after you can hear how we play the arrangement with dynamics, you do it. And you know, when I first heard it, it's funny because Todd, the engineer, and I are always arguing for years, 20-year argument about I hate booths and headphones and isolation for musicians. I always say, give the musicians the authority. And Todd always says, you got to give the engineer more control. I said, we don't need the engineers to capture the sound in the room. So this was all on our cell phones. And when we got finished, Camille Thurman did her vocal part and Veronica Swift did her vocal part. Then when he sent it to me, I said, damn, this sounds good, man, on cell phones. He said, you see what happens when you give the engineer control?
You're grieving the loss of your father, as so many people around the country, around the world, are grieving loss of their family members. How can music help us, help you, help all of us get through this type of mourning?
Well, you know, the music is it's like in New Orleans, how we do the music. Music is inside, it's invisible, so it touches all the things like memory and. Like, you know, in New Orleans, we played a New Orleans funeral. I think the deeper the music you listen to, the deeper you can get inside of your emotions. So you want to try to go toward musicians who have a certain depth of playing. That's why you got your Louis Armstrong and the kind of timeless masters, Beethoven, masters of that tradition, and people who sing Kalthum or those kind of singers who could touch people. Really deep down and could sit inside of an emotion, Mahalia Jackson. And it doesn't matter the age, even somebody like Patsy Cline, the way Patsy could, you want to be able to sit in your emotion and experience the grief and feel it, and then you want to be able to celebrate and come up out of it and have a good time.
Has it been hard for you to mourn without having people around?
No, for me, no, not really. I mean, I love my daddy so much, and it's so deep inside of me, the love I have for him. And he wasn't a really emotional man. Like, he wasn't hugging on you and all of that. He's very, but I just, I always express the love and respect and veneration for him. And I also, I always teased him and played with him, because he wasn't a big teaser and a joker. So, you know, he would leave me to tease him and play with him. And even in that conversation, the last real lucid conversation I had, I was messing with him about I could play better than him, or, you know. So I want to pick up the phone and mess with him. Because mainly at this stage, I was mainly picking up the phone and, man, did you see so-and-so? You better get on your instrument. You've been practicing your piano. I more dealt with him like that. Don't sound like you've been practicing. Because he was kind of shaking. He had Parkinson's, you know. So with his hands shaking, it was hard for him to even get his food up. So I would, instead of being, so I'd be like, man, they told me you were shaking so much you couldn't get your spoon to your mouth. I know I can play piano better than you now. Then I'd go play something on the piano, try to play something fast and miss all the notes. And he'd be like, man, you out your mind, man. So, you know, it was that me and him had more that kind of relationship.
One of the ways we deal with it in New Orleans is to march somebody out, to play them out the second line. You haven't been able to do that for Elvis Marsalis. I hope someday you will be able to do a second line for him, just like you did for your mother, I remember.
Yes,
so maybe we could end with you playing A Closer Walk with Thee, which is what you'll play for your daddy someday. Thank you very much, Wynton, and stay healthy.
Welcome. Thank you, man. Great talking to you.
Wynton Marsalis playing his father out. And since his father passed, he started the Louis Armstrong Emergency Fund to support jazz musicians in New York. And finally, a positive development on a story we've been following closely. Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe's temporary release from prison in Iran has been extended by a month, according to state media. The British-Iranian aid worker was amongst 85,000 prisoners who were released last month to limit coronavirus spreading through the prisons in one of the worst-hit countries. Nazanin's husband has campaigned tirelessly for her freedom since 2016, when she was arrested, tried, and sentenced amid allegations, which she denies, of plotting to overthrow the Iranian government. Nazanin's future remains unclear, but it is sometimes the small things that bring big hope. That is it for now. You can always catch us online, on our podcast, and across social media. Thank you for watching, and goodbye from London.
When you work next level. When you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.